The city of Flint, Michigan is known for many things. It was the birthplace of General Motors and was once the American auto industry's powerhouse for the first part of the 20th century. It's also the birthplace of filmmaker Michael Moore, who brought the devastating impact of the decline in America's car industry to world attention. And then, a decade ago, in April 2014, the ailing city experienced another tragedy, now known as the Flint water crisis. External administrators switched to a different water supplier, and residents soon complained about the smell, the taste, and the appearance of the new water, and started noticing rashes, hair loss, and other health problems. For 18 months, city and state officials denied there was a problem, until a state of emergency was eventually declared due to lead contamination. So, 10 years after Flint's water crisis, has the problem been fixed, and has justice been done? Dr. Benjamin Pauley is Associate Professor of Social Science at Michigan's Kettering University and the author of the book Flint Fights Back, Environmental Justice and Democracy in the Flint Water Crisis. Ben, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben, can you briefly tell us what it was that caused the Flint water crisis?
Well, I'll do my best. The most immediate cause of the crisis is that the city of Flint switched its drinking water supply in April of 2014, as you mentioned. Up until that point, ever since the late 1960s or so, the city had been getting its water from Lake Huron, which is one of the Great Lakes. It's a very high quality, stable source of water. The water source was switched to the Flint River in April, and that introduced instability into the system. The water was improperly treated at the water treatment plant. It was more corrosive than what the water system was used to. And so it had a disruptive effect on the system, particularly on the lead and iron pipes that make up important parts of that infrastructure. And so what residents started noticing, you know, initially was had a lot to do with the changing color of the water, as you mentioned. That was related more to the iron corrosion. As new facts came to light later on, they started to realize that the lead corrosion was an even more serious problem because of the public health threat associated with it. But it all came back to that more corrosive water that was introduced by that water source switch. And there were other problems too, problems of chlorination and so forth. But that really was at the crux of it.
Why did they switch?
Well, that's kind of a long story. So as I said, for many decades, Flint had been getting its water from Lake Huron through a system that's actually owned by the city of Detroit. And for most of those years, it was also operated by the city of Detroit. And Flint is kind of at the very northwestern extremity of that system, which is not an ideal place to be within a water system for many reasons. The water kind of takes a long time to get to you. They pump it uphill, so they end up charging you more for the cost of delivering it and so forth. And the city had also gotten frustrated over the years by the fact that, you know, Detroit had so much control over water rates. And so residents had seen their rates go up and up. And so eventually a plan was hatched to build a separate pipeline to Lake Huron that Flint would have more control over. It wouldn't be the only municipality that had a stake in that pipeline, but it certainly would have had more control. And residents were also promised that that water was going to be cheaper. It was still going to be Lake Huron water, but for various reasons, it was argued that the city would be able to avoid some of the rate increases that were coming out of Detroit. And so it was pitched to residents as an opportunity for Flint to really take control of its water future. The problem was that once they announced that Flint was going to be part of building that new pipeline, the city of Detroit said, well, we don't really want you as a customer any longer. And there's kind of a debate around, you know, just how possible it would have been to negotiate with Detroit. But suffice to say, the city ended up saying, well, in that case, we'll go ahead and use our Flint River while the new pipeline to Lake Huron is being constructed. And so that was only supposed to be a temporary measure, and it was supposed to save some money in the meantime. Often you hear it depicted as a cost-saving measure. That was part of the rationale. But there was also that kind of background of the tug of war with Detroit over control over the regional water system.
It was members of the community who sounded the alarm, but over time, independent scientists and investigative reporters also took up the cause. Ben, I wonder if you could chart out for us the cast of key figures in getting Flint's water problems dealt with and your assessment of their different contributions.
I can try. It was a lot of people who were involved. Yeah. And actually, you know, part of my personal frustration is that sometimes the story is told as a matter of just a handful of kind of extraordinary figures finding each other at the right time and making their individual contributions. And certainly there were, you know, impressive individual people that helped out at key times. But from my perspective, what led ultimately to the crisis being acknowledged and to some extent anyway addressed was the fact that you had such an outpouring of community expressions of concern, people taking, you know, the issues that they were experiencing to elected officials, to unelected officials, to the media, ultimately to academics as well, engineers, scientists who did at in the summer of 2015 work with some local activists to do an independent study of the water quality here. And that ended up being really instrumental in breaking the story open. But it really was that groundswell of community mobilization that I think set the ball in motion. And a lot of those people's names are names you will never read about, you'll never hear about. And I think it's important to recognize that, again, there, it really was necessary for a lot of people to raise their voices and their concerns. But, you know, as far as the individual contributions, I mean, there were particular activist groups within the community, like the Flint Democracy Defense League, like What Are You Fighting For, that played a really key role on the activist side. There were scientists from Virginia Tech University. There was somebody at the EPA by the name, the Environmental Protection Agency, by the name of Miguel Del Toro, who played a really instrumental role. There was an investigative reporter by the name of Kurt Guyette, who also helped with that sampling effort and helped also to sound the alarm within the press about what was going on here. So, you know, there really was this kind of conjunction of community mobilization and outside helpers kind of coming in at the right time and making their own contributions. And it was really through all of those collective efforts that the story was broken open.
We're speaking with Ben Pawley, author of Flint Fights Back, Environmental Justice and Democracy in the Flint Water Crisis. And Ben, a decade on, is the water in Flint safe to drink now?
Well, you know, we've learned that that whole question of water safety is a much more complicated one than I think maybe the average person appreciates who hasn't had as much occasion to think so hard about this kind of stuff. You know, when you're dealing with a large public water system, you're going to get some variability within that system. And we still have issues at individual homes where, you know, we've still got people in the city who are drinking their water through lead pipes that have not yet been replaced. There are others with other kinds of issues with interior plumbing and so forth, some of which maybe can be traced all the way back to that water source switch and the corrosion that resulted and so forth. And so, you know, personally, I've become very averse to making big sweeping statements about whether water in a big system like this is safe on the whole. By the usual measures, you know, which are established by our Federal Environmental Protection Agency and then enforced by our State Department of Environmental Quality, the water quality system-wide has improved quite a bit. Certainly on the lead front, we've got lead levels way down. Levels of chlorine are looking much better and so forth. But, you know, again, it's one thing to say that, well, you know, your system is in compliance with regulations. It's another thing to tell any one individual drinking water in their home that their water is safe. And we know that there are still issues of safety at that level in homes in Flint. And so, you know, my emphasis and my work and the folks from the community that I'm mostly, you know, working with is really on, you know, what are the next problems that need to be fixed here? Where do the, you know, issues with water quality remain? And so we still haven't taken care of everybody in the city of Flint with respect to their water, and we've got more work to do.
Yeah, certainly sounds like on just the clearing up of the pipes and the water, there's more work to do. And there's also the work of dealing with the long-term effects of what did happen. How much is known about the health impacts of the Flint water crisis? I note there was a journal article in Science Advances that was published last month, which says that existing estimates may substantially underestimate the overall societal costs in terms of impacts, particularly on young people.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And, you know, when you talk about impact in a case like this, you can talk about, impacts on the human body for sure. You know, when you're dealing with something like lead, you're talking about a toxic substance that is not safe at any level. So, you know, any amount of lead exposure is going to result in harm. Now, it might not be enough harm that you would notice it, or it might take a long time to manifest itself and so forth. So, and even when you're just talking about that kind of bodily harm, it can be very complicated, you know, determining what's causing what. And again, you've got to look over an extended time span. So there's some debate over just how much harm was done by lead. You know, one thing that is often missed in recountings of the crisis in the press is that arguably, actually, the worst public health outcome of the crisis was that we had a historic outbreak of Legionnaires' disease, which is caused by waterborne bacterium Legionella pneumophila, and we had at least 12 people die from that. And you know, nobody died from lead, but people died from bacteria in Flint. And so, that I think is a really clear impact that you can point to. But we can't just be thinking about the impacts to the body and the impacts to physical health. There are all of the mental health aspects of this. There have been numerous studies that have shown that Flint residents have higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. Certainly, you worry about this a lot with children. This was the subject of that article you mentioned, is looking at just kind of not just the physical impact, but the impacts on the minds as well of the young people in this community who know that they were exposed, who know that they were harmed. And we hear all the time from teachers in the Flint public schools here about just how many disciplinary issues they're experiencing and just how hard their jobs have become. There really does seem to be a trend. You know, we've got major issues with our testing scores and so forth. Actually, the school district is under an ultimatum from the state that if it doesn't raise some of those scores, it's going to be disbanded and absorbed into the county. So that's how bad it's become. And again, it's hard to say what particular thing is causing any of that. I mean, it could just be the stress of the situation as a whole, not just on the children themselves, but on their families and just all of the disruption to people's lives that's associated with that. But certainly it is a lot of impact to try to tally. And so I think these authors are no doubt correct that, you know, we've fallen short in that respect in terms of adding up just how severe the crisis has been.
One of the interesting observations in that paper is that racialized events within a community, such as the Flint water crisis, can produce a sense of social marginalization and subsequent civil unrest, which has been shown to affect academic performance. In what ways was the contamination of Flint's water racialized, Ben?
Well, Flint is a majority African-American city, and it has been for a few decades now. And the history of racial inequality and racial discrimination, racism, is, you know, a very large part of the city's history. And it goes back, of course, much further into the days when Flint was an overwhelmingly white city. And, you know, African Americans only had two neighborhoods to choose from if they wanted to live here. And if they wanted to work here, they were usually funneled into the least desirable, most dangerous jobs within the auto industry. And within the school system, you know, there was pretty intense segregation that, you know, people had to fight really hard to break down. And so, I of course don't want to speak for the African American community here, but, you know, I think it's safe to say that there are a lot of people who felt for a long time like their lives count for less than other kinds of lives. And that was a sentiment that was often expressed during the water crisis. They don't care about us. They're trying to kill us. Now, just to be clear, there were plenty of white folks who were speaking that way too. But I think that for the African-American community, one of the things the crisis did was that it reopened a lot of wounds that, you know, have been there for a really long time, because it did make people feel like they didn't matter. And another thing that I haven't mentioned yet, but that really must be stressed here, is that the key decisions that we are talking about water sourcing and water treatment and so forth, they were made by unelected emergency managers who were appointed by the governor of the state of Michigan to supposedly get Flint out of a financial emergency. And that background is important too, because when that happens, what that means is that you're stripping people of their local democracy and you're effectively taking over their city. And, you know, African Americans in this country have fought and died, you know, for decades and decades to secure the right to vote, to secure the right to self-determination, to be in control of their own lives. And so to have, you know, mostly white folks from Lansing, which is the capital here, you know, basically deciding what's going to be done with your city, and for you to end up being poisoned as a result of that, that has very strong racial, you know, overtones for a lot of people here.
Yeah, not surprising that there's a loss of trust and ongoing effects in terms of social cohesion. At the same time, there was an extraordinary community movement which was successful in many ways. Has that sort of democratic cohesion continued? And in particular, I know that there have been some sort of disagreements between some scientists and water advocates as the controversy has raged on. What's the sort of state of the civic society these days, Ben?
That's a great question. You know, I wish I could paint a very rosy picture for you. I'd love to be able to do that. But of course, I want to be honest. And the truth is that, you know, we continue to face a lot of challenges in terms of, you know, self-governance here, in terms of building up our capacity at the grassroots level. What we saw back in 2015, when residents were fighting to get off of the Flint River, was a pretty extraordinary coming together of a lot of different kinds of people. There were people who were already activists, who already had kind of a political analysis of what was going on, and maybe more of a political vision, not just around the water issue, but, you know, for the city as a whole. Then there was a whole other set of people who, you know, were not particularly political, who had simply experienced, you know, all of the challenges associated with contaminated water, and they were standing up for themselves and for their families and trying to make sure they were safe. We also had members of the African-American religious community play a really key role in that struggle. The network of pastors was really instrumental in kind of bringing people together and helping to create a coalition. As you mentioned, we also had scientists, including people from outside the community, come in. And you know, in those early days, it really seemed like this pretty extraordinarily diverse group of people working together cooperatively around the same issues. I think one of the reasons why that was possible in 2015 is that there was one very simple kind of objective that everybody had, and that was to get off of the Flint River and back onto Lake Huron water. Once that was done, you know, there was still a lot to do in terms of repairing the water system and reparations and accountability and so forth. But people started to differ a little bit on what exactly should be done, what the priorities should be. I think that's something you see in a lot of, you know, social movements like this. And so there was a little bit of dissension over that kind of stuff. There was also some personality level stuff, which again, you see in pretty much every social movement ever. Yes. But I think, you know, having one clear objective really helped kind of keep some of those dynamics in check for a while. And once that was gone, then yes, there were some fissures that opened up. And a lot of it did have to do with the controversy around the science of the water and some of those specific scientists who helped out, particularly the ones from Virginia Tech. There was a lot of controversy around some of the statements that were being made. And ultimately, you know, there was a lot of bad blood there. There was a $3 million lawsuit. There were other lawsuits. It actually got very ugly. And at least some of that revolved around a debate over whether it was appropriate to be declaring the water safe or restored or whatever language you like. But, you know, there were a lot of other dynamics at play there, too, that to me speak a lot to the really kind of tricky power dynamics that arise when you've got, you know, people with status and resources and platforms in the media and so forth coming into very vulnerable and marginalized communities. Those can be really tricky dynamics to navigate without leading to that kind of bad blood. And unfortunately, you know, we ended up in a very bad place there.
And the litigation you mentioned with the scientist was not the only litigation. There's been a whole host of litigation associated with the Flint water crisis. Ben, has justice been done after a decade?
Well, you've got to look at both the civil side of things and the criminal side of things. With respect to the criminal side of things, we had some pretty extraordinary charges filed against a whole range of public officials coming out of the water crisis, including the governor of the state of Michigan. And some of these charges, you know, included involuntary manslaughter. We're talking about really serious felonies. And these were filed across two administrations, so it gets a little complicated. But at the end of the day, all of those charges were dropped for procedural reasons. And so not only, you know, will nobody ever be convicted of a crime for their role in the crisis, nobody will ever even go to trial. And so from that perspective, that's a pretty extraordinary example of kind of undone justice. And residents are certainly extraordinarily disheartened by that outcome. On the civil side of things, there have been many suits filed, and eventually all of that was consolidated into a big class action lawsuit. And we now have a $600+ million settlement that's on the table, but it's been on the table now for years, and residents still have not seen any of that money. And so supposedly this year is going to be the year when they manage to finalize all of that. But it certainly has been justice delayed. And for residents who have, you know, for example, you know, lost their lives in the meantime, justice delayed is really justice denied in this case. And so it's been very frustrating.
Well, the anniversary is this week, and there will be a series of events to commemorate what happened. And I suppose, as your book says, the way Flint fought back, hopefully there will be some healing and unity, at least in those events. It's been really fascinating hearing about the Flint water crisis from you. Ben Pauley, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
Dr. Ben Pauley is Associate Professor of Social Science at Michigan's Kettering University. His book is published by MIT Press, including a free open access edition. It's called Flint Fights Back: Environmental Justice and Democracy in the Flint Water Crisis.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.